Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday evening, we gathered at Theater Cedar Rapids to talk politics with columnists Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan, as well as political reporter James Lynch. My co-host was Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Of course, we discussed the Kavanaugh controversy, but also trade with China and the outlook for the midterms less than 50 days away. Pints and Politics just ahead. First, this news. Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Today, coming to you from Theater Cedar Rapids, I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Aaron Jordan.
Wonderful to be, at least for me, the first time on the stage of Theater Cedar Rapids. It's a wonderful, wonderful venue. Nice to see everyone here. Our panelists need to be introduced.
That's right. So I'd like to introduce our Pints and Politics panelists. We're switching up our angle here. So on this close side, we've got Adam Sullivan, Gazette columnist. We've got James Lynch, Gazette political reporter. Linda Waddington, Gazette columnist. And Todd Dorman, our opinion and insights editor.
Well, front and center in our politics is the Kavanaugh nomination confirmation. At the time of this event, this will be broadcast on Iowa Public Radio. Perhaps it will be changed. I'm reminded of a line from The Wizard of Oz, people come and go so quickly here. So by the time this broadcast is on, we may have a different scenario, but right now negotiations are going on over the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford about her accusation that the Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, sexually assaulted her when they were teenagers. She was 15, he was 17, according to this accusation. So let's start off with that. Thoughts from our panel, perhaps just wide open, about, a week ago at this time, we did not know this name, Christine Blasey Ford, and it's developed, and the political parties have reacted to it, especially those on the committee in the Senate in charge of this, and especially we want to take notice that our U.S. Senator Charles Grassley is the head of that committee. Observations about how this has run the last few days?
Don't everybody jump in at once.
Adam Sullivan.
It's hard to say how this will shake out. Like you said, this has been moving very quickly. Pretty much, every few hours this past week, there's been a new update. One thing I'm glad about is it appears that if she decides to come and testify before the committee, it sounds like they're going to have an outside counsel, a lawyer, do that. I think it would have been a really bad idea. And if they do, it will be a bad idea to have senators themselves carry out this questioning. I think that just leads to a lot of really ugly political grandstanding on an issue that really does not call for it. Big picture, I would like to see the Republicans move to a new nominee. I support Kavanaugh on a legal basis before this all came out. He gets a right to clear his name if there's discrepancies, but the Supreme Court is the most important position in our government, and I think you need to have no blemishes on your record. You need to not only be a brilliant jurist, but also be, a very, very good person, and I think it's time to move on.
I'm not sure why Brett Kavanaugh would want the job now, to tell you the truth. It's like, if the Senate hearings weren't bad enough up to this point, and all the unneeded grandstanding. He's forever stained by this accusation, whether it's true or not. And I think, you know, for years to come, every decision is going to be analyzed. This will be part of the analysis of his opinion. Is this because, you know, something happened when he was 17 years old? How does that factor into his decision? So I think it's always going to be a distraction for him. It's going to be a distraction for the court. Maybe in 15, 20 years, people will forget it, but I don't think it's ever going to go away. Having said that, I have a problem with judging adults on things they did as children, as teenagers. It's always a problem because, you know, you think about your own youth, judging you based on sort of a unfinished human, you might say. It's a problem. This is a serious accusation, and it should be taken seriously, and I think Dr. Ford should be heard. I think, you know, appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee would be the right thing. I still don't know whether if it makes sense to judge someone on what happened in their youth.
I would just take issue with a little bit of that to say that no one's trying to banish this guy to sex offender island or something like that. But to be on the U.S. Supreme Court, yeah, I do think we can go back to your teenage years. And if there's, like I said, if there's one little blemish, I think that there's a lot of qualified jurists out there. Without that, on the Federalist Society's list, there are several women. I doubt that they would be accused of sexual misconduct. It's possible, but very unlikely. So I think for this position, I think we can have a very high standard.
There's a related question here from the audience. It goes back to 1991. Anita Hill testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. Her allegations were investigated with the FBI. In 2018, the Democrats and Ford have asked for an investigation by the FBI, but it does not appear that that's going to happen. The audience member asks, what does this mean for the Me Too movement?
So I'm going to go back to the previous question first.
Sounds like a politician.
I know. I do. I've been around him too long. It's rubbing off. But, you know, every morning I wake up and I check for my leg warmers because it does feel like 1991 again. But I can't find them. But, you know, we were talking about Kavanaugh's past. But when we have a young woman who comes forward to say immediately that this other young person has sexually assaulted me, the immediate reaction to that is, but what about his future? Well, what about the woman? What about the woman who's now stuck between their perpetrator's past and their perpetrator's future? I don't think it's too much to ask when you want to serve your entire life on the United States Supreme Court to spend an extra week going through an FBI investigation or some type of independent investigation, because this is a movie that we've seen before. We saw it with Anita Hill. It didn't work then. It's not going to work now. And it's extremely disappointing that Grassley, who's also seen this movie, doesn't remember how it ends.
Yeah, I mean, I basically agree that the president should make a new pick. I think he's damaged. I think I'm afraid that if she doesn't testify, that now we're going to see this kind of move forward as if nothing's happened. And I think that's wrong. And I think it will definitely tarnish his appointment. And I also think that as bad as the Republican Party's standing is with women, you've seen polls with the gender gap. I mean, it's enormous. This is why the gender gap is enormous, because this is how issues like this are handled. And so they need to rethink this. Think about not only the broader implications about who you're putting on the Supreme Court for the rest of his life, but also, you know, you represent the entire country, not just the folks who are clamoring to have this person put on the Supreme Court for lots of reasons. And as Adam said, there are all sorts of great jurists who have beliefs very similar to Judge Kavanaugh that would make good Supreme Court justices that should be tapped in this situation. I mean, it just, this should not go forward.
And, you know, we look at the Me Too movement and what's going on with that. What we saw after Anita Hill was supposedly, right, the year of the woman, because you had all these women step up running for office that were inspired by seeing a woman who basically was pooped upon. Let's use my little thing here. But, you know, we're going to see that again, probably even more so than we're seeing right now. What's in danger is this open conversation that we've kind of built where victims, whether they be male, female, children, adults, feel empowered that they can come forward and people will say, I believe you. I think, you know, that's what's in danger here, is that if this person gets completely dismissed, then other folks will think twice before they come forward and tell their stories.
I would just add, because I still hear this from, you know, from politicians or from people I know when they say, well, why didn't she come forward sooner? Well, look what's happened to her, right? She's the target of really hostile harassment, and that is not unique at all. That's what happens to women when they come forward with this kind of thing. So when you say, why didn't they come forward sooner, I think it's really obvious.
Let me just remind those listening on Iowa Public Radio, it's a special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. We're here at Theater Cedar Rapids. Aaron Jordan, my co-host here of the Gazette, also on our panel. You've been hearing the voices of Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, and James Lynch, and an audience of, I have to assume, political junkies here who are well engaged. We're reading some of their questions, batting back and forth some ideas at this ideas conference about politics. Aaron, did you have another question, or should
yes.
we venture on into another political topic here?
Yes, I think we should. I wanted to get into what the damage we've seen from Hurricane Florence. You know, North Carolina's been pounded. I believe the death toll has increased to 37. One of the big issues that's come up this week is how the vast amount of water is causing a real environmental disaster. Something like 21 large manure lagoons overtopped. There's, you know, power plants, other issues like that. I wanted to talk with the panel a little bit about what do you think the aftermath of cleaning up North Carolina and other affected areas is going to look like, and how's the federal government going to deal with that?
Well, it's going to be arduous and costly, as we know in Cedar Rapids, you know, cleaning up after a flood event and the, you know, flood events that no one has a precedent for. It's interesting, during one of the panels that I moderated today, it was about livestock regulation, and this came up. Someone asked, you know, what's the situation in Iowa? We've got this situation in North Carolina where manure lagoons have flooded and there's environmental impact. And in Iowa, one safeguard is that hog confinements can't be built within the 100-year floodplain. That's the law. But then we discussed how the 100-year floodplain doesn't necessarily mean as much as it did now that we're having more intense rain events. There have been researchers who say a 100-year flood is now four times more likely than it was years ago, so it's actually kind of a 25-year flood. I mean, we've seen the cedar go up this month, and now it's rising again after the rains we've had overnight and the day before. So, yeah, I mean, that's just one of the many things that people are thinking about. You know, in Texas, when the hurricane hit, there were chemical plants that were flooded and hazardous materials were released. As climate change sort of revs up our weather, and floods are unprecedented and things are occurring that we haven't planned for in the past, we've got to start thinking about that and planning for it, because I mean, with the manure pits in North Carolina and who knows what in Iowa and elsewhere, things are going to get flooded that we didn't anticipate. So that's all part of the calculation going forward, preparing for these disasters.
Well, it's like the general say, you always are prepared to fight the last war. And with these, you know, I think in recent years we've seen that with disasters and of this magnitude, that we're prepared for the last disaster. We're not prepared for the one that's happening right in front of our eyes. And obviously, you know, we need to do a better job of planning, but I'm not sure that we really have the answers if weather is becoming more and more intense all the time. You know, you're dealing with an unknown So I'm not sure we're ever going to get ahead of that.
Well,
but
yeah,
when you look at North Carolina and what they're going to be dealing with, it's I'm glad we're not on the coast.
Yeah, and I mean, we're not susceptible to hurricanes, of course, being in the middle of the country, hopefully. I mean, who knows? But
wait a couple of years.
But, we're building flood protection here. That's been an issue. We're talking about tax increases. I mean, who's to say that the 31 feet plus 3 or whatever they're building is, that's sort of the end of the conversation? I mean, we've seen again and again that the weather confounds our ability to predict.
Everyone was talking before the hurricane hit the East Coast about the possible political impact, hearkening back to Katrina on the Gulf Coast, and that during the George W. Bush administration. Do we have any political consequences from this? I know there's been talk of Florence, but also talk of Maria a year ago hitting Puerto Rico, and by estimates, by a university, it's not remembering what university it is, but there are almost 3,000 fatalities estimated in Puerto Rico, American citizens. So
that was a government, the Puerto Rican government had commissioned that report. So, yeah.
Well, I don't think we'll hear anybody say, doing a heck of a job, Brownie.
I did hear some man got a nice boat out of the deal.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, North Carolina. Well, I think probably the most astounding thing of all that is that, and this gets at the inability of Congress at this point to sort of be any sort of check on the executive branch. I mean, we've had this situation in Puerto Rico that, by all accounts, was mishandled, and thousands of people now we realize have died. And there hasn't been one congressional hearing on what happened, no investigation into what went wrong. So, I mean, I think the American people need to know that the government has learned from something that's been a terrible mistake, but in this case, we're not even interested in learning because the politics of it don't look good. And the president's on Twitter saying that this number has been made up by Democrats, which is wrong. But I mean, these are life and death situations. This is exactly what government's supposed to do. And if government can't do that, then we need to find out why. And so far, nobody really seems that interested in asking the question.
And is that because it's Puerto Rico instead of another state?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think to some extent that is the case. I mean, the president seemingly during the hurricane was more interested in sort of criticizing the mayor of San Juan and all of these folks. I mean, as we know, a lot of times it's all about him. But I mean, these are American citizens, as we said. And just because we made mistakes on an island doesn't mean we can't make, we made the same mistakes and to some extent in Louisiana and are capable of making them again unless we correct them, and we can't correct them if we don't know exactly what went wrong.
The really frustrating thing for me in this all is that certainly it was a failure on a federal level, as many people have pointed out, but the local infrastructure there and the local response mechanisms there also were not equipped to deal with it in the way they should have been. And I'm worried that that's not going to get the attention that it needs because we have a chief executive at the federal level who has injected himself in this situation to make it all about him. And it's not the administration's fault. It's a much broader federal issue and, again, a state and local issue. Or territory and local issue, and I think that's going to get overlooked. I don't think that they're going to make the reforms that are necessary at any level because it's turned into such a political sideshow.
So let's move on to talking about something that is international in quality but affects us here in the Midwest, especially with our agricultural output, both in commodities and in farm machinery. The trade war between the U.S. and China keeps getting bigger. This week, the Chinese government said they would impose tariffs on U.S. goods worth $60 billion. This follows the Trump administration's announcement. It was hitting $200 billion worth of Chinese goods with new tariffs. Our farmers are suffering here, but from what we know, they support the administration, or it's a mixed bag there.
I think they're pretty nervous. When you talk to farmers, they, I think a lot of them understand that, you know, we need a different trade policy, but I hear a lot of nervousness, especially as we head into harvest season. They're looking at the prices that you know, their bankers are looking at the prices too. So yeah, it's too early to tell. I don't think the demand for corn and soybeans in North Carolina is going to make up for the loss of the markets in China.
Well, there's been some polling that, and I don't know who supports the president and doesn't, but there's been polling. The New York Times have been doing some polling in the first district, and I think there's a district in Minnesota where they were polling, and the tariffs are unpopular. I mean, they're hugely unpopular. Does that translate into votes for Democrats? Well, I mean, in the first district poll, Abby Finkenauer's got a pretty commanding lead. So I don't know exactly how many of those anti-tariff folks are in her camp, but that seems to be a factor. And I think as we go through harvest and prices don't rebound and maybe even go lower, it's going to go from sort of this hypothetical, well, we're with the president, but let's wait and see what happens. Well, we're to the point where we've seen what happens. And then I think the political fallout could be fairly substantial.
This isn't even popular with his party, really.
Right.
I mean, you think about our congressional delegation, they really haven't come out and criticized the president, but they say things like, you know, farmers want trade, not aid. Well, that's not exactly supportive of the Trump policy. So and you listen to Republicans around the nation, I don't hear a lot of Republicans saying, yep, he did the right thing, we're going to come out of this better. If they do say it, they're hedging their bets. You know, that people think we need to take on China, that we should have stood up to China a long time ago.
Is that a point of agreement, James, that there are, China is engaging in unfair trading practices? That is a point of agreement across the parties, right?
It seems to be, yeah. Yeah.
So it's just a matter of how to deal with it, how to combat those unfair trading practices. And maybe this is a case of a short-term pain for long-term gain. If you would I'll go along with the president and be patient in this case.
Well, and that's what we're hearing the president say, and some Republicans are saying that too, and they point to the aid package for farmers and say this will help them get through it. But, I don't think there's a whole lot of support for tariffs generally, and especially if I'm bearing the cost of it.
And I think this whole notion of short-term pain, long-term gain is what you said. What happens when the Chinese markets have moved elsewhere? You know, and they're getting their soybeans from Brazil or whatever other country. You know, that's not short-term pain, that's long-term pain. And when I'm out talking to farmers, that's what they're concerned about, is being completely replaced in the international marketplace.
We're going to take a break here at Theater Cedar Rapids and come back with Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, and James Lynch, Aaron Jordan at my side. It's Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River, the Gazette partnering with Iowa Public Radio. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We'll talk more state politics and then also ask our panelists. We talked about the trade war with China, and perhaps you can answer this question because our panelists will toward the end of our program today. With all these tariffs that China is imposing on us, we are imposing tariffs also on Chinese goods. What good product from China would you like to tariff out of existence on our store shelves? We'll try to figure that out when we come back. It's Pints and Politics, River to River, from Iowa Public Radio News and the Gazette. Thanks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this special edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Pints and Politics, coming to you today from Theater Cedar Rapids. Co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette and our esteemed panelists, James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan. All of the Gazette, let's welcome them back for our second half hour. Yay. This half hour we want to dedicate mostly to state politics, but we're also including our congressional races in that as well. We have a number of questions from the audience, so what do we want to start with the governor's race?
We're going to start with the governor's race. We've got a couple of really good questions here along those lines. So the state governor's race, we have Kim Reynolds facing Fred Hubbell. You know, those races, I was just looking online, and Real Clear Politics says it's a toss-up. What hot topic, if any? You know, so far we've had a real personality debate, but what hot topics, if any, are going to be the tipping point in this election?
Yonkers.
Yonkers.
I'm missing Jake Porter. I thought he was also running for governor.
The Libertarian.
Yes. Is that up here?
It's true.
Yeah. It's true.
Let's add the Libertarian candidate in this conversation. I bet it changes the conversation significantly.
Well, it kind of does. I would expect Jake will get 2%. I think that's his goal, is to get 2% and maintain major party status. I think it's a very real possibility that 2%, one way or the other, to whoever loses out of the major party candidates, that would have put them in a different position. So I think it is possible that actually changes the equation to some extent. But as these guys have said, I think... I really see it as personalities and then kind of a proxy battle for all these federal issues that are going on. I really don't see, you know, on the positions that Hubbell and Reynolds hold, I don't see that those are the things that are going to drive people out to vote.
Mm-hmm. So, Adam, let me be sure I understand. You're saying that Jake Porter is going to be the Ralph Nader of this race?
He could be.
I bet if you went out on the street and said, what would a Libertarian governor do mainly? There would be some blank stares. There would educate us and tell us has any state ever had a Libertarian governor, and what would that governor be directed toward doing?
As far as I know, Libertarian Party members have held basically zero partisan offices in the United States. And I don't think I'm exaggerating by much. It might be a county auditor somewhere in some other state, I don't know. But that is a challenge. So they've been a political party for 50 years. They've had almost no electoral success. And so it's kind of like, well, what are you guys doing here? But the fact of the matter is, they did get, their presidential candidate got 2% in Iowa last time around. And so under Iowa law, they're an official major party. And so the fight that Porter's put up recently is that he wants to be included in the debates because he represents an official party. And I think that's a good rule. If you just say the official parties, they get into the debates, I think that's fair, it's clean, and it's consistent.
I just want to talk more about the Libertarians. You know, we kind of laugh when we say they only got 2% in the last election. They're hoping to get 2% in this election, but the fact is we don't include them. We didn't even include them tonight at Pints and Politics. We said we have a governor's race against Kim Reynolds and Fred Hubbell when we actually have other people in the race. So if we're not even including them in the conversation, how do we expect them to get to 2% or more? So I don't necessarily think it's funny. Sorry, audience. But I don't see anything policy-wise driving the governor's race at all, except perhaps Medicaid would be the only thing that's out there.
Okay, explain that a little bit. Inform us about the Medicaid differences in these candidates.
Explain the Medicaid differences between their policies?
Yeah, what these candidates stand for that is different when we talk
we
Medicaid.
We have one that supports managed care, which was unilaterally decided by her predecessor. And we have another one who would like to return the state to either some type of hybrid or full state control. And I think that's the essential difference.
Is that something that matters to voters?
Yes. I actually think that's the one issue that, it makes sense to people. You had a system that may have had flaws. I think people were in favor of maybe fixing the flaws, but then it was turned over sort of in a unilateral decision without a lot of input from those affected and given to private corporations, which, you know, as bad as, you know, government and Congress sort of get approval ratings, large corporations don't do a whole lot better. So I think people understand that this transition, at least, you know, there have been a lot of stories of people who have been harmed by this. And the Hubbell campaign has done a good job of going around the state and highlighting that, bringing people to round tables to talk about This is how I was harmed. I'm a patient who can't get the care that I need. I'm a healthcare provider who can't get reimbursements, and I'm going to go out of business unless these MCOs actually pay my, you know, pay my reimbursement that they owe me. So it just seems like a government decision that harmed a lot of people, and that resonates. And I actually think that's probably the one sort of big policy issue that's probably hurting Kim Reynolds. And the fact that they're sort of trying to put a happy face on it and say, well, you know, this is all, these are just all anecdotes, and overall this is positive. I don't think people necessarily believe that. And that's a big problem for a campaign.
We could ask, and please be truthful about this. When you applaud, this means that you have been negatively impacted by the change to privatized management of Medicare. Applaud now if that's the case. Okay, an audience of what, 150?
There's probably at least a dozen folks out there who clapped, and in this size group, that's not insignificant.
Well, and it doesn't include the people indirectly affected whose family members or extended family members have been affected. I think Todd is right. This is the one policy issue that could affect the outcome of this election. And it's interesting, just today, the Iowa House Republican Caucus newsletter went back and looked at a 2010 projection by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency on Medicaid costs and compared it to where it actually is today. And basically they said, if nothing is done, it's going to be, you know, I don't remember the numbers, but they projected out what it would be costing the state, and it's less than that now. Well, there's some reasons we know why it's less, because they're offering less service. It's not just that they're being more efficient. But the reality is that it used to be when legislators and the governor's office and those folks sat down to do the state budget, they said, okay, how much are we going to give to education? How much are we going to give to everything else? Now it's to the point where they say, how much are we going to give to Medicaid, or how much do we have to give to Medicaid? Now how much do we have left? And so, the cost of Medicaid is driving this. The fact that people are getting less service is, I mean, a consequence of that. I think we all want the best care for our family and for our neighbors. The reality is, how much do we want to pay for it? It's not like, you know, Kim Reynolds is going to write a check for this, or Fred Hubble can write a check for it. But how much are we willing to pay for it, for that care and that level of service? And I think that's the part of this whole debate that is missing. I mean, we can see the results when we see Tucker, you know, in the commercial on TV. We can understand how it's impacting him. But we have to choose to pay for it.
Now, I think what's missing from the conversation is that we didn't have this conversation. So we didn't have debates at the State House. We didn't have public hearings that moved around the state. None of this was justified. And maybe this is where the state really needs to be. Maybe this is the best place. But it was never sold to Iowans.
Well, and when no one buys into it, then when things go wrong, there's nobody to defend it. Right. I mean, this is basically a decision solely made by one administration, and now they own it. And owning it is not a great thing for them electorally.
Yeah. It also brings up the point, so, I mean, everyone agrees, certainly all the Democrats agree that there's huge problems with managed care, but none of them are necessarily clamoring to get back to a purely state-run system. You know, they all acknowledge there's huge and rising costs with this that need to be addressed in some way, and it does need to be a broader conversation. And one worry that I have is it looks somewhat likely that we could have split government here in Iowa after the election. It's really hard for me to see how either a Republican or Democrat governor and, you know, a chamber on each side, how they would come together and get anything done on this front. And I think that's really concerning.
So we've got another audience question here related to the governor's race, which now I will restate involves three very important candidates.
Well, there's four.
Thank you, Aaron.
You're welcome. Should Fred Hubble produce more of his income tax records, or like Donald Trump, will it appear to be irrelevant?
So I don't think it turned out to be irrelevant for Trump. Obviously, he still won the presidency, without that, but that was it was a pretty big ding on him. People still bring it up. Fred Hubble needs to release his tax returns. And the only argument you hear from Democrats to defend Hubble is to say that Trump didn't release his tax returns. Well, duh, Trump's not on the ballot this year. And so to deflect and have that other conversation. Yeah, Trump should have released his tax returns if he runs for re-election. Absolutely, he should. We need to be clear about that. But we're talking about Fred Hubble right now. He was very involved with politics and government for a long time, a very wealthy individual. And the opportunities for him to get wealthy off of his government volunteer work were ample. And he needs to show us that that's not the case.
And the fact that he doesn't release them only raises more questions. I mean, it does raise the question of what's he hiding, and whether he's hiding anything or not, I guess we'll never know.
You know, I will add that if you're a member of a political party and you're willing to look the other way for someone who's running for office within your political party, you better be prepared to look the other way when the other party does the same thing.
If you just joined us via Iowa Public Radio, Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River, coming to you from Theater Cedar Rapids with Aaron Jordan, James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan of the Gazette. I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio. Talking about state politics as we get toward the end of this conversation, let's move into what is deemed, Aaron made a reference to it, as I guess we would agree, the most vulnerable incumbent in the congressional races in eastern Iowa, the northeast first district here in Iowa, Rod Blum facing Abby Finkenauer. Let's talk about that too. What narratives do you see emerging there, issues that may be decisive?
I think this is a race that is in some ways a referendum on Donald Trump. It's a referendum on tariffs and trade policy. It's a referendum on electing a woman to office. I'm not sure anybody knows where they stand on policies or that they're really talking about them.
This is personalities and gender.
To a large degree, yeah.
I would say, though, as we discussed further, you know, there's pocketbook issues with tariffs and things like that. I think that plays some part in it.
And I'd add ethics.
Ethics.
Yeah.
Go into that. Yeah. You're resonating with the audience, Linda. Go into that a little bit.
Well, we had several things that happened that were reported by the Associated Press. That Rod Blum had failed to disclose certain business interests and whatnot. He later went back, and I think he corrected that record, didn't he, James?
I think so.
But in any event, it's out there. He's now being investigated by the House Ethics Committee, which then he threw up and said this was just a partisan attack against him. That's just simply not realistic. That the House Ethics Committee, which is run by Republicans, would be a partisan attack against Rod Blum is kind of funny.
Rod Blum is someone I've supported in the past. I'm with him on the vast majority of the issues. I think the ethics violations he's had are not unique in Congress. There's certainly other people who have dealt with the same things. But no, it's true. There are. But the thing is, the way that Rod Blum has responded to those is the problem. So I don't know who's doing his polling, what kind of advice he's getting, but this defiant attitude, this don't take any accountability thing, to me, from where I'm sitting, clearly is backfiring. So, that's all. Dug myself a hole there. I tried to get out.
One of our audience members wants to know if clean water plays a role in this race in Iowa.
In which race?
Well, the first district. And I suppose any race here in Iowa. Clean water, dirty water, has been an issue for many years here in the state.
Well, and there's also a lot of concern up in northeast Iowa about the karst topography and the animal confinements and that kind of thing.
I don't think it's as much an issue in the congressional race as it is in state races. I haven't really heard much discussion in the context of the congressional race about clean water. There's some concern about the Mississippi, but not so much about the karst topography in Northeast Iowa and that driftless region and stuff. So, no. I mean, I think it's, like I said, it's more of an issue in state races.
Okay, talk about that a little bit, because could we see in this election one or maybe the Iowa House or one chamber go back to the Democrats? Could this be an issue that does it?
I don't know. The map is really hard in the Iowa Senate. It's plausible in the Iowa House. But they would certainly need to win the governorship and pick up a lot of votes along the way to make that happen, is my understanding.
Well, I think if Fred Hubbell were to win and the House were to flip, I think there would be, I mean, Fred Hubbell was one of the large initial donors to the campaign to put the trust fund in the Constitution, the Natural Resources Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. So I think he would be interested in filling that with a sales tax increase. I don't know exactly how that would fit into his initial budget or whether that would be a priority, but I could see that happening. And if Democrats were, controlling the House, you might get a compromise somehow with the Republican Senate. The big fight will be not necessarily to raise the tax, which would be, there would be a debate over that, but then you get to the funding formula for that trust fund, and that's where you're going to have the fight. Farm Bureau, other interests don't want to see a lot of that money go to recreation. They don't want to see it go to trails. They see that as some sort of land grab. But, there's a lot of sentiment, I think, especially among the voters who approved it, that they wanted some of that money spent on outdoor recreation and trails, and that's rural economic development to a large extent. So I think if you did see if the trifecta turned to a dual-fecta with a one-fecta, you might see some of that.
Be a fecta mess.
Yeah, you'd see a lot of effecta from that. So
today, this afternoon, a report came out, an investigation of the Iowa Finance Authority, looking at allegations of sexual harassment by the former director, David Jamieson. And just reading through that 35-page report, the law firm that did the investigation said that there was indeed sexual harassment that went on in David Jamieson's hands, and sometimes literally at his hands. And and they also found that there were people within the agency that knew about it, although they were clear to say no one outside of the Finance Authority knew about it. But they made some recommendations in terms of having if you have allegations against the director, you shouldn't have to report them to the director. What does the panel think? Do you think any changes are needed in terms of how those sorts of allegations come forward to make it so, if you're reporting, you don't have to report to the director if the director is
that the makes one. Sense. I mean, that's just common sense that it should be. There should be an alternative way to report a situation like that. And it's a problem in some state agencies that are relatively small, where even if you don't come forward publicly, everybody's going to know who came forward. In some of these agencies, there's basically the agency and one administrator. So there has to be an alternative, whether it's going to directly to the governor's office or, now the Legislative Services Agency has this human resources officer. Maybe that's an alternative.
I was in sessions this afternoon, so I haven't actually read the report that you're referencing, so this isn't directly related to that report. But I think we need to remember that we had someone within that department that elevated those concerns to the governor. And even though I personally disagree with the governor on some other issues, she handled this really well. And we owe her kudos for doing that. And I think that's a difference that we see when we elevate women into positions of power.
Yeah.
So going back to that original question, should there be a different avenue than reporting to the person who's harassing you? Come on. Yeah, we should have a different avenue. We should also remember that where there's a will, there's a way, which is what we saw happening with David Jamieson.
To end this discussion, I want to come back to something we referenced to earlier, which is the trade war with China. And sort of as a thought experiment, it's interesting to think about, well, go to the stores that you frequent. I don't know if it's Walmart or Lowe's or whatever, Office Depot, and imagine there are no products there. All the products from China disappear. How many products would be left? So the question for the panelists to finish up here, if you had to pick a product made in China that you could tariff out of existence in the United States, what would it be?
Well, see, I wondered whether it would, Terry Brand said coming back would count as an import. So that's where I don't think it would, but that's where I was at. So
I got nothing.
That was rude, Todd. You should have gone last if that's what you were packing.
He couldn't wait.
You know, I was trying to think of anything that I was actually passionate about enough to want to push out of existence. I can't think of anything.
Shout it out from the iPhone?
Fireworks.
Oh.
Fireworks.
Great.
This is America.
My dog would be totally in favor of that, sir.
And that finishes up Pints and Politics, recorded yesterday evening at Theater Cedar Rapids. Our producer and audio editor today, Emily Woodbury, sound engineer Jim Davies. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.